greatest threat to our planet is the belief that somebody else will save it. Therefore, it is so important that organisations and individuals do their part to protect our planet.
That is the voice of Robert Swan, a man on a mission. And this is the Undaunted Podcast with Robert Swan and NTT Data. Hello, everyone. I'm Dan Smith with NTT Data, and we're a principal sponsor of Robert's upcoming expedition to Antarctica. He calls it Undaunted South Pole 2023. Robert is quite familiar with the world's polar regions. In fact, he earned his place in history as the first person to walk to the South and North Poles. For more than 30 years since that achievement, he has traveled the world, speaking to presidents at global summits and elementary school students in their classrooms, with the singular goal of protecting Antarctica. We all have a vested interest in that continent's fate because 60 to 70% of all the fresh water on Earth is locked in ice that covers Antarctica. That data point can be hard to conceive, so consider it this way. Almost all of Antarctica's land is covered in ice that is at least a mile thick, and often much thicker. You'd have to drill more than 1.5 kilometers to hit land. And now picture this. That mile-thick layer of ice would cover all of the United States, including Alaska and Hawaii, plus the ice would cover Mexico and Central America, as well as Colombia and Venezuela. That's the scope of frozen fresh water we're talking about, and that is just one important reason to care about Antarctica. As Robert Swan says,
mark my words, please, that if we continue to melt this, we swim.
How do we avoid that fate? Well, that's the ultimate purpose of this podcast. In January of 2023, Robert will seek to complete a long-time goal of walking across the entire breadth of Antarctica. He's already crossed most of the roughly 1,600 nautical miles on foot, and with Undaunted, he seeks to cover the remaining miles and accomplish his dream. NTT Data is proud to sponsor this effort and to help Robert advocate for Antarctica and sustainability. We're a top 10 global IT services provider, and we drive digital transformation for clients in more than 80 countries. Our top corporate priority is realizing a sustainable future. And when Robert spoke at a company event, we saw a perfect match. Here's what he said to the audience of employees, family, and friends.
We, all of us, are on a journey which we have to succeed on. And that is a journey towards sustainability. But I believe fully that good sustainability means good business.
In this first episode of the Undaunted Podcast, we'll share Robert's story about his death-defying walks to the South and North Poles. In future episodes, we'll speak directly with Robert and other experts about the journey towards sustainability, and we'll consider this from business and personal perspectives. Along the way, we'll explore the power of taking a positive approach, the power of incremental actions at scale, in other words, how small steps add up to big things. And we'll consider the power of teams fueled by personal determination. In fact, determination is a great one-word summary of Robert Swan's mission to protect and preserve Antarctica. Here's how it all started.
This began for me at the age of 11, last time I was properly dressed. And at the age of 11, I saw a film about the real explorers who went to the North and South Poles. And I watched that film on Christmas Day, and I said to the family, I'm going to walk to both poles. Made that commitment. Everybody laughed. They still laugh. But in between, we achieved that mission. So it began with a dream.
The movie that changed Robert's life was Scott of the Antarctic, which told of British Captain Robert F. Scott's South Pole expedition in 1912. That was during the heroic age of polar exploration, when Scott, Ernest Shackleton, and Roald Amundsen raced to the South Pole. Captain Scott did reach the South Pole, but the Norwegian Amundsen got there first, and Amundsen lived to tell his tale, while Scott and his team perished during their return. Even so, Captain Scott earned an immortal place of honor in the British psyche, which led to the making of a movie that would shape the trajectory of an 11-year-old boy's life. Now, let's fast forward to the early 1980s, when Robert began to seriously plan his walk to the South Pole. His first modern problem was the same challenge explorers faced in the heroic age: money.
In my life, I've tried to be a good salesman. I've raised, I calculated it yesterday, $67 million in order on a regular basis to try and go and kill myself, which has been unsuccessful so far, but let's just see how that goes.
For his first expedition, he only needed $5 million. But in the 1980s, Robert Swan was unknown and had no polar experience. His pleas for funding were met with icy rejection. But that didn't stop him from renting a warehouse on the Thames as his South Pole expedition headquarters. When he wasn't out scouring for money, he read Captain Scott's journals over and over, and he determined to follow his hero's exact route to the South Pole. He even dubbed his expedition In the Footsteps of Scott. Robert originally thought he could raise the money in about 2 weeks, but that turned into 2 years, then 3, 4, and 5 years with no money. Now, for just a minute, put yourself in his parents' shoes when friends and family inquired about Robert's activities.
After 5 years of trying, no one would sponsor me. My family talked in terms of counseling and psychiatric help. They still do, but they did more then. People would say, what's Rob doing? Oh, he's in a warehouse in the East End of London. Why? He's trying to raise money to walk to the South Pole. Why? Has he raised any money? No. And people rightly said no to me. They said, you're going to go and die.
Rob's big break came in the person of Jacques Cousteau, the French naval officer and oceanographer whose books and stunning documentaries educated the world about the oceans.
He became my patron. Lucky to get him. And he gave me credibility. I was then able to raise the money, but being Jacques, he said, Robert, you must do something for me. I said, tell me, get on the phone, help get my money. And he said, at the end of your expedition, I want you and the team to leave just your footsteps in the snow in Antarctica, take away your garbage, take away your rubbish, leave Antarctica clean, show respect to the place, and I'll help you. I said, done deal, get on the phone.
As the funding tide turned, Robert also received support from the descendants of Captain Scott and Ernest Shackleton, as well as corporations, and also from school children. It all added up, and Swan was able to buy a ship, which he christened Southern Quest. It was a 550-ton North Sea trawler, and Robert needed a ship because you couldn't fly to Antarctica at the time. A few dozen volunteers signed on, and they helped fit the ship with ice-deflecting plates and gathered the necessary supplies, and for their efforts, volunteers could sleep in the drafty warehouse. Finally, after 7 years, Robert's dream was in sight. Southern Quest arrived on the shores of Antarctica in February of 1984, near the end of the polar summer. The ship could not arrive earlier because of pack ice on the sea, the same stuff that snagged Shackleton's ship decades before. Winter would begin in March, so the team had to hustle, unloading 64 tons of materials and supplies, building a 16-by-24-foot hut, and ultimately leaving 5 men behind to survive the winter. Namely, Robert Swan, the dreamer and doer, Roger Meir, the navigator, Gareth Wood, the organizer, Mike Stroud, the doctor, and Captain John Tolson, the photographer. Their supplies included 600 sacks of coal for heating the hut and barrels of fossil fuel for an electric generator. Survival, not sustainability, was the theme for that expedition, but that would change on future expeditions. With all their supplies tucked away and the hut constructed, the men stood on the shore in the waning summer and watched Southern Quest sail away.
And if you ever think you've had a bad day, try this one. We watch our ship sail north, becomes a dot on the horizon, and we know, five of us now, are locked into Antarctica. We won't be connected for a year because it didn't exist. We have no radios, no telephones, no communications with the outside world for one whole year. We will only speak to ourselves. And we hope like hell the ship comes back a year later to collect us once we've reached the South Pole.
They saw the sun for the last time on April 23rd. After that, darkness reigned 24 hours a day. Temperatures inside the hut hovered around 65 degrees Fahrenheit, just over 18 degrees Celsius. Outside, the air was so cold it could freeze the teeth in your mouth.
Now, five of us go into our tiny little home that we brought from London, and we now wait. We wait for 9.5 months inside this stinking hut. 4 months total darkness outside. The temperature will fall to minus 80, and we hated each other's guts even in London. I am number 7 in a family, youngest, and I realized early on in life that why people upset me is because they're right. So I didn't choose my best friends for this. I chose the right people for the job. We might not have liked each other, but if everybody was the same, we would have died. We needed diversity to make this happen.
As months passed, they made a couple of short forays in the dark to see penguins and once to climb Mount Erebus, but mostly they tended to their respective chores and tried not to tear each other's heads off in the hut. On August 23rd, the sun finally returned, and as they ventured out into the daylight, penguins looked on with curiosity from the beach.
9.5 months, we come out of it. Three of us now lay out our equipment on the edge of the Antarctic continent. More people had stood on the moon than had walked to the pole. We would be the first people for 100 years to go to the South Pole overland on foot. And every single person said, "You are going to die." We will accomplish, if we make it, the longest unassisted march ever made anywhere on Earth in history. And we knew we could do it.
Particular care went into packing the sledges each person would pull, filled with equipment, fuel, and food. The trip was unassisted, meaning no supply drops along the way. So each person had to pull everything they needed for the 900-mile trip. Weight was a critical consideration. Daily calories were calculated precisely. Historians believe Captain Scott's team might have survived if they had planned for just a few hundred more calories each day. Rations for Swan's team included 80 days' worth of military biscuits. Doesn't that sound good? But they also had Cadbury's instant hot chocolate, instant soup, freeze-dried peas, bacon bars, and pepperoni. They also would melt half sticks of butter into their daily soup for extra calories. They planned to cover the distance in about 2.5 months, reaching the South Pole station with almost 0 calories left in their supplies.
We believed we could do it, but we knew we'd get thin because we couldn't pull enough food on our backs. I would lose 69 pounds in body weight in 70 days. This is going to be hard. Off we go. Each sled, 360 pounds. No radio, no fancy GPS to press a button, completely unassisted. No one's going to know where we are. And we must navigate using the sun, a sextant, and this old watch to find one building about twice the size of this room in the center of the Antarctic, 900 miles away, the South Pole Scientific Station.
If they make a mistake with their calculations, no one comes home. Following in Captain Scott's footsteps, Swan's team set off on November 3rd from the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf, a crevasse-filled, glacier-fed ice formation about the size of France and riding on top of the sea. The ice shelf was 1,000 feet thick, with 100 feet of it exposed above the water. Still today, it looks very much like the ice wall in Game of Thrones. Their route would cross three distinct regions: the Ross Ice Field, which accounted for the first 400 miles, followed by 120 miles across the Beardmore Glacier. That second stage would ultimately rise to 9,000 feet above sea level. Then came the last 350 miles of icy plains, the Antarctic Plateau.
So off we go. We must cross 5,000 crevasses. And if you go down one of these things, you don't come home. We carried no ropes or ladders. And to get through this, we had to trust each other fully.
In this case, trust meant actually putting your life into another person's hands.
We had to trust each other's judgment. Whoever chose the route across the crevasses, the other two would follow that unconditionally and without debate. Why? Because if we'd stopped 5,000 times to have a feedback session, you know, discuss our feelings on the issue, we'd still be there talking about it.
They walked 9 hours a day, on skis, 7 days a week, for 70 consecutive days. They only took a break if the wind was blowing too hard. As the expedition progressed, their feet developed blisters and moods became dark. The stress of ever-present crevasses gave way to sastrugi on the Antarctic Plateau. Sastrugi looked like waves, but they're actually mounds of solid ice, formed by persistent high winds and often rising a meter or more in height. Not ideal for pulling a heavy sled. Those sastrugi-forming winds were another challenge all their own. One day, a blizzard stirred up the highest winds the area had seen in more than 25 years. And yet, they persevered. Finally, on January 11th, they spotted the outline of the South Pole Station, a little bump on the flat horizon. As Swan and company covered the final miles to the pole, Southern Quest was returning to their base camp on the coast. According to plan, Southern Quest carried a plane that would meet the team at the South Pole and fly back to base camp, where they would pack up all their belongings and rubbish before sailing back to civilization and returning the site clean back to the Penguins. It was one of the best laid plans, you'd think.
Those last few miles to the South Pole, they actually live in my nightmares. Because if we got it wrong, 1 degree of latitude, wrong time, we would have missed the pole by 50, 80 miles, arrived there, 2 days left of food and no South Pole. Dead. But I was with the best. Roger and Gareth navigated us, wait for it, 300 yards off course in 900 nautical miles by sun, sextant, watch. We'd done this. There lay the South Geographic Pole. We had done it. What a moment.
There is an actual pole at the South Pole. A silver orb about the size of a basketball sits on top of a striped barber's pole. The Swan team gathered around it to celebrate an astounding human accomplishment.
And as we were doing this, the base commander came out from the South Pole, a giant man with a beard. And he was weeping, crying. And I thought, well, Americans are a bit emotional, but what's going on here? And he looked at me and he said, "Mr. Swan, I've got bad news. Your ship sank 5 minutes ago." 5 minutes, just the sort of bloody thing you want to hear when you've walked 900 miles to the pole, that your ship sank 5 minutes earlier and you've spoken to no one for a year. 5 minutes.
After Southern Quest had returned to Antarctica, the ship became trapped and was crushed by the worst pack ice the region had seen in 30 years. As the crew struggled to free the ship, a fire broke out in the engine room and forced a hasty evacuation of people, emergency equipment, and provisions onto the ice. Tents, radios, food, rafts, and navigation equipment. $20,000 of cash went down in the ship's safe. No time to get it, and cash would not keep anyone alive on the polar coast. The ship sank in about 30 minutes, and the ice was stained red from the ship's paint. The 21 crew members were safe, thankfully, but everyone was stranded, and Robert and two colleagues were still at the South Pole with no way home. The government entities were not eager to help, to put it mildly, but eventually assisted with flights to New Zealand. Three members of Swan's team stayed behind for a year to tend the base camp.
Got a few problems now. You can't insure a ship this far south on the planet. I promised my fabulous bank manager that I would sell the ship on return to pay my debts. No ship, no insurance. So I go bankrupt, I lose everything.
Back in England, Robert pulled a lecture tour together while working from a drafty office in a cheap part of London. At each lecture, Swan and friends would collect money at the door themselves, and they sold t-shirts and posters of their South Pole adventure. Audiences ranged from a large crowd that gave a standing ovation at the Royal Geographic Society to a cavernous hall with just four people, including a colleague's mother. He did pull enough money together to rescue the men who had stayed behind. That rescue required a dramatic series of flights by the legendary polar pilot Jules Kershaw, accompanied by Robert. Everyone finally made it home safely, and a Greenpeace ship ultimately helped with the cleanup at base camp.
To cut a very long story short, we did what we said we were going to do. And you know something, in a world where words are becoming cheap, I think it's important that one thinks carefully before you make a commitment. And then once you commit, do it.
Now, let's back up to the year Robert was presenting lectures. Once he rescued his colleagues, he was still saddled with more than $1 million of debt. He needed something bigger than lectures. What he needed was another expedition. It's a time-honored tradition that explorers pay the debts of one expedition by mounting a new one. And Robert never lost his boyhood dream of walking to the North Pole. The full scope of a northern expedition germinated in his mind as he was flying over the Drake Passage to pick up his friends who had stayed behind at base camp.
I thought, we'll go to the North Pole, deliver the dream, and pay off the debts. $1.2 million at the age of 28, personal debts, and I'd never had a job. So I thought this was a good idea. Well, it was really, but it doubled the debt. But honestly, who cares? Off we went.
This time, he recruited eight people from seven nations: Australia, Canada, Germany, Japan, Russia, the UK, and the US. They dubbed this expedition Ice Walk, and together they would walk 700 miles to the North Pole. The journey would ultimately take 56 days.
So the North Pole is a frozen ocean. So you take a step off ice on land, stand onto frozen ocean and keep walking away from the safety of land. Very bumpy, rough conditions. This would be our home for 56 nights in a row, eight of us from seven different nations.
Historically, the Arctic ice froze solid every winter, and it did not break up until summer. That's what the team was counting on, but this year was different. Unlike Antarctica, where the sea ice extends 900 feet below the surface, the Arctic sea ice was just a few feet thick, and it would undulate with the ocean waves. Some days, the team had to crawl on their hands and knees, pulling their sleds, while the ice rose and fell like a frozen seesaw on a playground.
I have to be honest in saying that I hate doing this stuff. I mean, living in a tent with smelly men for a start is not much fun. Pulling a sledge 9 hours a day, 7 days a week for 70 days in a row isn't much fun. So I was really looking forward to getting to the North Pole and never having to do this ever again, ever. So we're 100 miles from the pole. I can feel it. We're going to do it. And then in 2 days, the nightmare begins.
The team climbed a 60-foot pressure ridge in the ice and gasped at what they saw. The North Pole ice was melting earlier than ever before, and black fingers of open water stretched out as far as they could see. They were 600 miles from the nearest land.
whole ice starts to move beneath our feet. No one knows where we are. We don't have radio communications. We just have a beacon that will set off when we reach the North Pole, create a runway on the ice, and hope like hell a plane can reach us. But then this happens.
That night, inside a tent bobbing on a frozen slice of ocean, Robert considered what was happening to the Earth's polar regions. Confronted with a drastic change in climate conditions, he resolved to dedicate the rest of his life, if he lived through this, to protecting the poles by promoting renewable energy and sustainable lifestyles. But first, he and the team had to survive the ice walk. The next morning, he was prepared to end the expedition and return home. But Misha, the Russian member who was experienced in Arctic waters, said the team could navigate their way across the ice and open water, so they kept going. Sometimes they had to jump across open ocean between blocks of ice. Oftentimes they had to walk south temporarily to keep going north.
This is 30 years before words like sustainability, climate change, global warming, none of those words existed. So we weren't standing there going, oh, this is climate change. We were going, great, we're dead. Because in 20 hours of trying to go north, 20 hours, we're still going south, pushed by the ice. And basically, we're dead.
Robert admits he could not see a way forward at that time. But his teammate from Japan, Hiroshi Onishi-san, said they should stop running on 24-hour days. Because it was always daylight, the team could move to 40-hour workdays. That would allow them to move forward faster than the ice was pushing them backward. And that's exactly what they did for a week. And then...
10 miles out, we get some luck. The wind changes. The ice comes together and bingo, we've got there. We reached the North Pole, job done. And I thought it was important to fly the flag of the world. Perhaps more important now than it's ever been. But it was a great moment. We had done this. And I'll be honest in saying, I'd still be in the warehouse in London talking about doing all this stuff if it wasn't for everybody else. We had done this. It was a great moment.
Just after Ice Walk concluded, Robert's friend and benefactor, Jacques Cousteau, called again.
Jacques Cousteau hauled me in and he said, Robert, didn't say well done for reaching both poles, good job removing the rubbish from the... Nothing of that. He said, Robert, what are you doing for the next 50 years? And I thought, oh God. I said, can I have a cup of tea and tell me what I'm doing for the next 50 years? And 31 years ago, he gave us a mission. Because in the year 2041, the treaty that preserves Antarctica, keeps it for all of us, unexploited, untouched, we could change it. It could be altered. And it's our last chance on Earth to show that we were capable of just leaving one place alone as a natural reserve land for science and peace. Last chance. We've been working on that for 31 years, 19 years to go.
The end of Robert Swan's walks to the South and North Poles marked the beginning of a much larger global mission. In the next episode of Undaunted, we'll speak directly with Robert about what came next for him, biking across India, circumnavigating Africa and the world, speaking at consecutive global summits, his many returns to Antarctica, and how he's building advocates for Antarctica through his 2041 Foundation. We'll also talk about his next venture, the Undaunted South Pole 2023 Expedition. The quotes you've heard from Robert were delivered at an NTT Data meeting last May of 2022. He had just returned from one of his annual International Antarctic Expeditions, which he uses to create champions for the continent. This time, something unusual and disconcerting happened.
Just back from Antarctica 2 weeks ago, obviously, just the most extraordinary place to go. But I have to say, it rained. I've been going to Antarctica for 35 years. Never rained once. And I just think that the urgency of making our personal and business commitments towards sustainability no longer in debate. No longer in debate.
If you wonder how to begin your own personal or business commitment, you're in the right place because we'll be covering all that in future episodes. Before we end this episode, I want to introduce you to a closing feature of each Undaunted podcast, something we call cold hard facts. One of the cold hard facts about Antarctica is that the entire continent is a desert. Robert was shocked to see actual rain on the continent earlier this year because it typically gets about as much annual snow as the Sahara gets rain, which is to say, not much. So how on earth did the Antarctic ice sheets become a mile thick and more? Well, it's an illustration of the power of incremental actions at scale. The icing of Antarctica began more than 40 million years ago. Those few centimeters of snow and ice crystals every year have piled up for millennia. Along the way, Antarctica captured a significant majority of all the fresh water on Earth. Tiny things can absolutely add up. All right, friends, we're going to give Robert the last word for episode one. I hope you'll join us next week for round two of the Undaunted podcast with Robert Swan and NTT Data. Thanks for joining.
So I end by saying one thing, and I've tried and failed to live by these words. And the words are, if you can do or dream you can, begin it now, for boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Good luck to you all, and thank you very much. Thank you.